Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
I am Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
There we go. Looking down the table, there's Toxie sitting there. Dudley's got a big smile
present
on his face.
And, present.
We got Lanny's is absent, but we have a de facto Lanny sitting in his chair.
All right.
And we may end up enjoying this, Mark. So, look, I've been looking forward to having Mark Thomas sit on our couch and let us ask him questions for years. And now he's sitting right there.
Yeah.
I'm just Toxie. This guy has been around a long time.
Yes.
And he has such a wealth of knowledge. Dudley said it earlier. We've got a wide array of questions we can ask Mark.
Is that a polite way of saying he's getting old?
Well, Mark, you know, when I look at
I resemble that remark.
We kind of all do. Mark, welcome. We're glad to have you.
Thank you so much. And it's an honor to be here. And it's an honor to even be invited. And when you asked me about doing it, I remembered a story about 35 years ago. I asked Toxie to attend a meeting for me in Birmingham. And it was a company that was investigating the idea of leasing lands to hunters, which was a novel idea at the time. And Toxie was building his business, and he had a handle on the direction that the market was going. And he, out of kindness, came to Birmingham. We had our meeting, and that company leased their land shortly after, and the industrial companies picked that up. Other REITs and Timcos did, and by now, it's an old story, but hundreds and hundreds of thousands of hunters have high-quality places to hunt because of a meeting that Toxie went to 35 years ago.
Oh, my God. Hit the horse for that.
Yeah, that's high praise.
So is this timber company land? Is that what
all,
you're referring
all
to?
All industrial company land, a private Timco land, timber industrial management companies, mm-hmm. and REITs, real estate investment trust funds. So all these lands at that time were not leasing lands because they thought that it was a potential conflict with local hunters. And even large industrial companies didn't lease their lands at that time. Many of them were afraid of arson fires, quite frankly, in that arena. And as they started leasing these lands, all that dissipated. The hunters took care of the land. Mm-hmm. Everybody benefited. It was a win-win situation for everyone.
It makes my heart, you know, feel good that we created access for people because, I mean, you hear me all the time. Time, actually, the word time. Time is our most valuable asset. So we love this stuff so much. To every year that passes and you have people out there that want a place to hunt, they want access and don't have it, it makes my heart kind of cry.
Heck yeah. So let's learn a little bit about you, Mark. Let me do this first. So guys are listening to this. You look like you're in fantastic shape, and I think you're pushing 70 from what you said.
Bobby, if you walked 70 miles a week, you would be in good shape too.
You know, I want to ask you, what do you do to stay in shape? But when I'm looking at you, you look like either Theodore Roosevelt or Mark Twain. Which one do you get the most?
You know, there's a couple people that I'm confused with. One of them is a guy named Dr. Red Duke.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, some of your listeners will remember him. He had a 5-minute medical spot on the news. And like when I go to the Northeast, especially when I'm flying up to Jersey or New York or LaGuardia or even D.C., ladies still come up to me and hug me, and they say, Dr. Duke, you've helped me so much through the years, you know, and I don't want to let them down.
You don't want to push the hug away. No. I know, but you don't want to do.
I get that a lot. I get Mark Twain a lot. I was doing a job recently on a trail system, an ecosystem restoration job, and I got back to my truck. And there were the police officer there. And I got to talking with him. A lady had called and said that Albert Einstein was out stumbling around in the woods.
There is a resemblance. There's some, we should post that for
crazy
people.
Deranged
he
man.
He actually does. Now that you mention it, there is a eerily similar resemblance.
But, you know, I used to see Mark at trade shows, you know, before I knew about his professional career and really who he was. And he would be dressed up in this mountain man garb and teaching kids, you know, how to shoot a bow or something, or doing all kinds of kids things. And little did I know that, you know, he was as big as Mark Thomas is in so many different ways.
I do stay in shape primarily by doing most of the work myself, which I enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. I have H2B crews for my tree planting. We plant about 60,000 trees a day per crew. It takes us 19 days to plant 1 million trees. It's very physically demanding work. I do all my ecosystem.
All double bar?
All HODAD.
HODAD.
I use only HODADs in my crew.
Wow.
And those HODAD are hickory shafts. The start of the season, they're the size of your forearm. By the end of the season, they're the size of your index finger.
Wow.
That's worn down by skin, human skin. Mm. It's incredible.
It's called a HODAD?
HODAD crews. Yeah, I use HODADs. Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever. That's probably a good thing.
It's a fast. You can plant 6 trees a minute with a HODAD all day.
Almost like you're just. I mean, you almost
fast
don't even.
As you can walk.
Yeah, you don't even see the tree being planted. It's so fast.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be this expert on so many subjects.
You know, I always enjoyed hunting and fishing and camping and hiking and canoeing. And I grew up doing all those things. And I was interested in wildlife. And it just so happened that the university in my town where I grew up had an excellent a Bachelor of Science degree in Wildlife Management. That was Missouri State University in Springfield. And then I went to University of Missouri in Columbia for my master's, and they had an excellent forestry school, one of the top forestry schools in the country. So I cross-trained accidentally before it was really even a known thing to do. Now it's much more common, but I got a Bachelor of Science in Wildlife Biology and a Master of Science in Intensive Silviculture. And then I moved down to Auburn. And the reason I moved there for the PhD was because it was becoming the breadbasket of the world from a forest management standpoint as the Pacific Northwest shut down due to the spotted owl controversy and other things. And what we really did in the South over about a 5-year period is, I call it the Southern Silvicultural Revolution. We increased forest productivity 9-fold. We went from 0.5 cord per acre per year to 4.7 cords per acre per year in a very short period of time. It was the greatest redistribution of wealth in the history of America. We took billions of dollars out of the economy in the Pacific Northwest and we inserted it into the Southeast. We became the breadbasket of the world, and we were driving that cyanamide at that time with the introduction of the imidazolinone chemistry, drove that whole Southern silvicultural revolution. Because we had a tool we could apply over the top for release of loblolly and longleaf for site preparation. The wildlife market alone was a $100 million a year market. We made $1 billion a year during those periods. Of course, that was in agriculture too. And that's when I first met Toxie and Mossy Oak.
So, Mark, you've got your company, Forestry Integration. What I'd really like to focus on is how you guys and how you in the past you've helped landowners and clubs and leases improve their habitat and whatnot. So with all this pine tree knowledge that you have, when you kind of think about all the timber company leases or that are across the South, what can those guys be doing right now what will those timber companies allow them to do to help improve their properties and improve the hunting?
Okay, well, I started my company, I left corporate in December of 2000.
Wow, that long ago now.
Yeah, that long ago.
I still remember it.
Yeah, I left on a Friday. I did an exit interview up in New Jersey. Got back late that night. I had my first client just south of Columbus, Mississippi, the next day, Saturday morning. I drove up on this property with him, and we went about 10 yards into the gate, and I looked at both sides of the road, and I said, "Pal, you got to whack 100 does." He said, "Really?" He said, "Why? We hadn't even got in past my gate yet." And I said, "Well," I said, "shut the truck off a minute, and I'll show you something." He had a line of eastern red cedar on both sides of that road that was browsed up about 5 feet off.
Oh, my gosh.
And I mean, they were, if a white-tailed deer is eating eastern red cedar, that's the same as you and me eating a moon pie box. Just like eating cardboard. It has no nutritional value. It's an emergency stuffer.
Gosh, it's probably even worse.
Yeah. So, you know, we see that a lot. But what I try to do is when I work with these clients, and I have a number of categories of clients. You have NIPFLs, which are non-industrial private forest landowners. You have TIMCOs and REITs in the investment arena, and I put trust officers and trust accounts in that. You have PICs, private industrial companies. A lot of that land base has sold to the investment arena now. There's been a real transition. You have consultants. You have smaller timber companies. When I look at their lands, there's a number of primary philosophies on land management and land ownership and how to enhance wildlife habitat, not just for white-tailed deer, but for game and non-game species, breeding songbirds, neotropical migratory birds. I have clients that want butterflies. It's whatever the client really, the objective of land ownership. But the first thing I normally do is to enhance what I call QVM, or quality vegetation management. That's the cheapest thing you can do. It's the least expensive, the least labor intensive, and has the biggest impact on the ecosystem. It's QVM. After that, I look at sanctuary establishment, which is centrally located in the middle of the property. After that, you look at the addition of agricultural food plots. Depending on your deer density and your carrying capacity, then you add supplemental feeding to that, another leg on that stool. And then at the end, you're really looking at the hunting equation, how to enhance huntability. QVM can be complex. It can be extremely simple. It usually equates to timber harvesting, thinning, in many instances, selective herbicide treatments, fertilization, and prescribed burning. So once you do that, once you look at the macro ideas to manage this property, depending on the land ownership, then you look at the huntability aspect, which is getting your leaseholders on board, or your landowners, or your family members, whoever it is hunting. And there's about 10 or 12 things I usually recommend there, not on every property, but on many properties. So there's the idea of interspersion index enhancement.
I want to hit on that
at
some point.
Which is extremely important concept in land management. Then the implication and the addition of ecotones. Then I look at viewing lanes. Sometimes you need to observe antler morphology before you can shoot down your shooting lanes. You've got to look at those bucks for enough time to determine antler quality. Then travel lanes, feeding lanes. And then in some instances, I'll establish stalking lanes, which I call blind corner herringbone stalking trails.
Lanny would like that.
Get on the ground and hunt them on the ground.
You can't sit still long enough to make that work, though.
There's nothing like it. And then access trails to your hunting blinds or shooting houses. I look at the wildlife stand improvement a lot, especially in low-quality hardwood stands. I do a lot of injection, a lot of in-the-woods food plots like honey holes, and then kind of roadside maintenance at the end. So those are about the 10 or 12 specific things that I usually recommend on many properties, depending on a number of factors.
See these people? When the clock strikes 5, it's not the end. It's just the beginning. They have to do these things. They have to do those things.
Enter the all-new LS Tractor MT2 and MT2E, a relentless force of innovation. Redesigned with a new hood and cab built for comfort and visibility, with enhanced lifting capacity to get the job done. Making these people the ones everyone else calls those people. Visit your local LS Tractor dealer today.
Moultrie has pioneered the game management category. Today, Moultrie is one of the best-selling brands of feeders and seeders in the world, and they continue to innovate with new technology that gamekeepers will rely on. Moultrie products are always field-tested and designed for hunters by hunters, combining forward-thinking innovation with time-tested practicality. Moultrie, first in feeders since 1979. All right, so guys, Moultrie is offering our listeners a 15% site-wide discount at MoultrieFeeders.com. Use code MossyOak with a capital M, MossyOak, at MoultrieFeeders.com and get that 15% discount. Right now we're seeing, and thank goodness, we see these hashtags, more fire, more feathers and whatnot. But I want to ask, can a guy burn his place too frequently?
You can. You can. The quail cycle is the shortest for you know, quail are very early opportunistic species. You've got to burn on a 1 to 3 year rotation to keep that early successional habitat where a young quail can move through. If it gets too thick, they just can't, they're not mobile enough. But for turkey and for white-tailed deer, I like a 5 to 7 year rotation because you want that material to become dense and to produce early successional plant communities and herbaceous plants and flowering plants, legumes and rubus, partridge pea, lespediza, all that. And you can just do maybe one herbicide application with a selective chemistry followed by a burn to release serotonous seed that require fire to germinate, and then keep that in a early successional plant community for 5 to 7 years before you have to even introduce prescribed burning. And then I like a relatively cool fire that's not removing all the organic matter on the soil. You're just trying to knock back low-quality hardwoods at that point. And then sometimes 10, 15 years down the road, you'll actually do another selective over-the-top herbicide treatment, either with skidders or articulated forwarders or a helicopter. You can go through the top with helicopters.
I've heard people using drones now.
They're doing it. They mm-hmm. sure are. There's ag drones and there's forestry drones.
And I also heard that, and I don't know who would do it and how to charge. They were doing the, you know, obviously smaller selective spraying than you could do with a helicopter.
If you don't have a seed pool that's native to the organic matter layer of your soil, you can introduce seeds.
Well, how do you improve the quality of the herbaceous community?
Normally, you'll see the native seeds in the seed pool germinate after a herbicide treatment followed by a prescribed burn. So you want to do a fall treatment, September, October, and then followed up by a prescribed burn.
Yeah, like what kind of herbicide?
Normally imazapyr.
Okay.
Because
mm-hmm.
it's rubus and legume tolerant.
Right.
So you're trying to eliminate the low-quality hardwood component, and that increases the light availability, nutrients, water, and most importantly, rooting volume. Because below the surface of the soil, the rooting volume is taken up by low-quality hardwoods. So your herbaceous plants really can't thrive because they're competing below the ground. And that's why mechanical treatments don't work well. They remove the vegetative portion of the plant, but they do nothing to enhance rooting volume. And rooting volume is really where you're trying to improve nutrient uptake, water uptake. And by eliminating the vegetative portion of the plant, you're increasing light availability. You observe on a kind of a test plot what comes back, because that's your native seed pool. The native seed pool is actually valued at about $500 or $600 an acre. That's already there that you don't have to spend. Now there are places, like you mentioned, that don't have a native seed pool available for manipulation. Normally, those are agricultural lands that have been converted to forestry, and the native seed pool was depleted because of agricultural practices that might have been going on for 20, 30, 40 years. So there you can reintroduce a native plant. And then they'll just become self-perpetuating and they'll thrive. So you do a, you just kind of look at see what comes back, and then you figure out how to manipulate that. Normally, you don't have to do much, and just let it. You can do a fertilization with a native plant fertilizer, which I've used with micronutrient, and that increases the protein content. And like you say, that's the deer can smell that protein in those plants, and that's what they're going to start hammering. So you want to look at your deer density, your carrying capacity. The deer are eating about 8.5 to 12 pounds green weight a day. That's 3,000 pounds a year. That's a ton and a half. So you got to produce a ton and a half of high quality food per animal on the landscape. So that's an important feature. Your maximum antler morphology is usually met at 50% of carrying capacity. So if you get your deer population too far above carrying capacity, it does cause a reduction in antler morphology. That's why sometimes you'll add supplemental feeding to increase the protein per animal, because the environment just can't do it, even with agricultural food plots sometimes, depending on the number of acres involved. I've got some clients that will have 400 acres of soybeans, you know, in the middle of their property. They don't have to worry about supplemental feeding. But a lot of clients have 80 acres or, you know, 200 acres. So you've got to look at that whole equation, determine how many animals you can raise, keeping those parameters in mind.
For the most part, across the South, and I think now in most places where that whitetail deer are thriving, we've got too many deer, it sounds like.
We've still got some deer density issues going on. Yeah, there are a lot of enclosures that I work with, and I love enclosures, because in an enclosure, you can hunt deer like the Native Americans did 1,000 years ago. You know, it's a 1-to-1 buck-to-doe ratio. It's a balanced buck age structure. You've got true seniors in the herd. You've got 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old deer.
Wow.
That most hunters have never seen a true senior deer. You got the balanced buck-to-doe ratio. You got a good twinning percentage, high survival. And it's fun to hunt in an enclosure, because you can take a deer sniper stand and a set of tree spikes, and you can go up a tree and rattle, and you'll have six different pairs of bucks fighting in front of you with 18 subdominant bucks around the circle watching, and it's just crazy.
So is that more because they're able to have a denser herd, or is it because of the 1-to-1 ratio creates that competition?
It's both.
Yeah.
So you can have everything in enclosure, but it's labor intensive. It's expensive. It's not for everyone, but where you can afford it, it's a hunting experience just like nothing you've ever seen compared to a wild land situation. There we do have situations where there are too high deer densities.
So we've got a lot of deer. We've got pigs now, Martin. There's so many different things that are working against us. And you and I, Toxie, when you weren't privy to this conversation, we were talking about, I asked him, how's this turkey season going? And he said, hey, I've been going to a place for, Mark, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Tell what you, when I ask you. What
the turkey population in much of Alabama is in decline. Mm-hmm. It's in decline in Missouri. It's in decline in most of the, what I would call the central range of the eastern turkey. Now up, we've got a place in northern Maine, and NWTF and the state wildlife officials reintroduced turkeys there. And that population is exploding, flocks of 80, 90, 100 birds. And you'd think, how could they live during the winters? But the snow just brings more groceries down to their level. So the more snow they get, the more food becomes available, because they're on higher ground every time it snows.
Oh, wow.
It's crazy to even think about. They had a very mild winter this last winter.
I didn't think about that. A deer would push down through the snow and can't get through it, but turkeys just float on top.
Yeah, they just,
how about that?
Just opening another refrigerator door.
That's crazy.
That's
awesome. So, but, so there's hope for Canada and places.
Oh, definitely. Awesome. The northern tiers are going to explode in turkey populations.
That's incredible.
It'd be crazy hunting.
You're a smart guy. What do you think's going on down here with the turkey?
It's complex. I think blackhead has taken a lot of turkeys out of the population because they have that flock characteristic, so that they're spreading it among themselves. I get a lot of calls from clients who are noticing blackhead on their land, in their population, affecting their mature gobblers. I got a call a couple of days ago, a mature bird just standing in a road for 2 days, turning around in circles with just the heads, just big carbuncles all over their heads from the avian pox. So that's happening. I think when hogs move in, turkeys tend to, for whatever reason, they either move out or the nest predation is so high, they just don't have the regeneration anymore. So hogs, I think, affect turkey. I think coyote predation is causing turkeys to probably call less because the coyotes are getting on them so fast now when they're calling. We have nest predators, snakes, possums, raccoons that are affecting.
It seems like there's more raccoons than ever. I think
there are. You know, when I went through my bachelor's degree, I worked as a laborer on the Frisco Railroad, the midnight shift. I somehow managed to cram a 4-year degree into 7.5 years. And I would bed down to 4 to midnight during coon season. I'd take my dogs to work, tether them under the viaduct at the rip track, and then I'd clock out at midnight and I'd hunt till daylight and then go to school all day. I paid for my college education with coon furs. They were grading out at $54 a piece.
Wow.
And I'd catch 10 or 12 a night and leave 20 up a tree. Now you can't give a coon pelt away. You're lucky to get a dollar.
Wow.
And that's affected. There's no more coon hunters. They're not trapping. They're not reducing the populations that are out there. They're living in holes with civet cats, getting mangy and getting distemper and getting rabies. And so, you know, we need to all start buying our wives fur coats because natural fur is what drives that market of hunting fur-bearing animals. And we need to continue to that, because when we do that, we have more turkeys and we have more quail. And I think fire ants is another depopulating agent that's hardly ever mentioned. But a study in Texas saw mortality in whitetail fawns of 25% from fire ants. When those fawns are born with that embryonic fluid on them, those ants are just starting to sting them, and they die from stress within 3 to 5 days.
And they hit
every nesting bird. Those fire ants are on them. They're foraging. For every one visible mound, there's 19 subterranean mounds. And a queen will fly 20 miles. So there's so many fire ants now. Usually I'll do a broadcast AMDRO in any type of nesting habitat.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Is there friend of mine probably 8 years ago was talking about a friend of his. I don't want to call any names, but y'all would know him. And he had this friend, I think he had 2,000 plus acres in Georgia, beautiful, beautiful land. Of course, Georgia can be so productive. And he, according to him, there was something new at the time, so go back 8 or 10 years, that was completely environmentally safe, but would take care of your ants.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's AMDRO or something. I don't know. Yeah. He said he spent, I want to say this guy spent $25,000 or $30,000 or maybe more to crop dust his whole place with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in subsequent years, he had an explosion in his turkeys. Hmm. Now, you know, does that prove anything or not? I don't know. But sounds really interesting. It was just a story I was told. I would trust what you would say about that, because if it's happened anywhere, you would know about it.
Yeah, it was probably an aerial application with a simplex agricultural seeder out of a helicopter of AMDRO.
AMDRO is a safe to everything.
What's the active ingredient in AMDRO?
Hydromethanone.
Okay.
And it's applied at extremely low rates. It's only a pound per acre. And I apply it through Moultrie spreaders on my six-wheelers. I got 3 spreaders, 2 in the back and 1 in the front, and I can fertilize or lime or spread AMDRO. AMDRO tends to cake when you're bouncing,
right.
So I only put about a pound at a time. And I actually it sounds weird, but I have a kind of a rope to tie it to the top of, and I'll, every now and then you got to shake it.
I do that when I'm doing with the seed sometimes, and basically planting clover and different things. And I have to, you know, chufas will hang up really bad on the little Moultrie cedar. So I'm constantly, I don't have, the rope's a great idea. I'm always banging on it with my hand and getting a bruise.
So I know we're going to have some listeners ask, that doesn't affect non-targets like, you know, crickets or whatever turkeys would eat, grasshoppers.
No, it affects grubs. It affects nothing. And the important thing about that is you can only do it in nesting habitat. You don't have to do it everywhere. So you can be very specifically applied. It's only a pound per acre, and you want to broadcast it because the foraging ants, and you want to do it about 10 o'clock in the morning or later. It's got to be warmer. You don't want any dew on the grass, so you need to have the dew dried off. And then the foraging ants pick it up. They take it inside the nest and kill the queen. So then the ant mound just disappears. I did a grass strip one time for a French count down in Florida. He had a private plane, and he was hitting those mounds, and it was actually causing his plane to wreck. He would crash his plane because of his tires, because it was a grass strip. And so we put that out there. We didn't have to apply again for 7 years, and we only had a few mounds then. So it does completely remove them, but the queens will fly, you know, redeposition over time, but it 5 to 10 year interval.
Interesting.
It's interesting, but in Dallas, there was a neighborhood that was infested with fire ants, and they're biting all the kids. They actually did a door-to-door educational outreach. They got a waiver from every house in that neighborhood. They did an aerial application of AMDA with an aircraft, with a fixed-wing aircraft, completely eliminated fire ants from that subdivision, and they've never had any redeposition in that subdivision. They completely removed them from that whole housing complex.
You know, guys can think about this. Mac, I'm looking at you. You shoot doves a lot, but wherever I've ever lived, knock a dove down. Sometimes, I mean, you might wait a few minutes to go pick it up.
They'll be covered.
It's amazing how fast they get on it. So covered. I think about a fall.
A minute. Yeah. A minute.
Eggs cracking. Yeah. So we're never going to get rid of them, are we?
No.
Fire ants can't penetrate like the egg, can they?
No, they wait for the embryo to pith. The first time they pith the egg and that embryonic fluid starts oozing out of that crack, that's when they start getting on them. By the time they're hatched, they're already covered.
It's probably one of the healthiest meals they eat.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
and you
wild.
Know, they like, for example, if a human is standing near a fire ant mound and they start coming up your pant leg, they reach a critical mass, and the fire ant is so ingenious that they can sense when that critical mass has reached. And when they reach that critical mass of density, then the first one stings you releases a pheromone. Mm-hmm. And that pheromone goes through that colony in a microsecond, and every one of them bites you at almost exactly the same millisecond.
I've had it happen a bunch of
times.
Yeah,
me too.
Well, I grew up a barefoot buck out here north of town on this prairie land, and this clay soils here in the Black Belt or ant capital of the world, literally fire ants. And so I had it happen so many times. And you know, how many times have you seen someone doing a crazy dance in the dove field and stripping their clothes off?
Yeah.
Well, they never knew they had ants on them until the one up next to their crotch bit them, and they were covered, pants, legs, everything. It is amazing.
Lenny, I had to tell you, hunting with you, you've got your phone in your pocket. You're constantly checking on X.
Yep. Very valuable key features all in those things. It really is. From the compass mode to recent imagery, I mean, it really helps you understand where you are spatially, where you're headed, where a turkey is, where he was. It's a heck of a tool to use in the spring woods.
I didn't realize that they're updating these maps every couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'd have never known about that clear cut that you were hunting if I didn't have that recent imagery.
Well, you know, and you could share some waypoints with me.
I could share some points with with you. You're exactly right.
I mean, it has that capability.
It does have that sharing capability, which is great. You know, you're wanting to show me where your goblin turkeys are.
Oh, man. You know, Onyx, it's a great app.
It's a great app.
So guys can go to onyxmaps.com/hunt and use code Mossy Oak to get 20% off.
There you go.
I'm a big fan of Onyx.
I am too.
We've been on this insect conversation here, you know, and this is another semi-controversial topic, I guess you could say, that I've heard in the last couple of years. While we're on this, seed treatments, you know, people row cropping, putting treatments on seeds. I know you've been like an expert witness, and you've been in the herbicide, insecticide type field for years. What's your take on, you know, for example, turkey scratch going up a row and eating the purple and green corn seeds, and how that could affect things?
You know, they would ingest such a minute quantity of that material, and most of it is, you can either have lipophilic or hydrophilic compounds. The lipophilic compounds adhere to adipose and become encapsulated, and that's kind of how the bodies of mammals will compartmentalize that material. The hydrophilic compounds are voided in urine almost immediately after ingestion. So I've done a lot of studies. In fact, I was a research associate at the ETSRC lab in Missouri, which was the Environmental Trace Substances Research Center. And I looked at the distribution of dioxin in 19 different species of animals in 5 organ systems. Dioxin is a 2,3,7,8 tetrachlorodibenzo-p-dioxin isomer, which is supposed to be the most toxic substance known to man. There was no increased mortality of mammals, and I studied in Times Beach, Missouri, which was where the material was applied for dust control on the road, and it was actually bottomed from chemical industry. All of the species that we studied had extremely high body burdens in their adipose of dioxin, but they were all older aged and healthy and living a normal life. So I kind of concluded from all that work that we have a system that encapsulates toxic substances in our adipose and basically just wards it off from our body. And I don't think that that would ever really be a mortality inducing instance, because it's at such small quantities. People were worried about Lay Lake in Alabama about eating the fish because it had a trace of dioxin in the fish. So I did I looked at the edible fillet and the fat content of the edible fillet, and I calculated how many fillets a person would have to get a 50%, the LD50, mm-hmm. that would induce mortality in 50%.
Lethal dose.
Yeah, they would have to consume 55 gallon drums of fillets at one sitting to get an LD50. Well, if you spread that over a 50 or 60 or 70 year lifespan, you could never, and it's being encapsulated or voided. So dioxin is a lipophilic compound, but most of the compounds you're talking about are hydrophilic. So they're just voided in urine. So our bodies are designed to flush that stuff out, and it's an ingenious invention.
You want to rebut that, Dudley?
No, not at all. No.
It would behoove anybody farming or using this to not spill a bunch of seed or something like that. Because, right. I mean, I thought about corn. Corn's what, average plant depth, 2.5 inches right. deep. It can come up from pretty deep. Most farmers plant it really deep. And so likelihood of being a turkey scratch up much, it's slim. I know that hogs can wipe out. I've had them wipe out 50 acres, and literally it never germinated. I mean, little, right. maybe 10 plants per acre.
Right.
Would even, they're that efficient in going down 2.5 inches underground and getting every single seed.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible.
They smell that.
But it doesn't seem to affect them.
No,
no matter how much they ingest.
It doesn't. And it's such a short-lived in the environment because of microbial degradation, which is almost immediate. You have aqueous photolysis. You have mechanical breakdown. Those compounds break down so rapidly into inert compounds.
So, Mark, I want to take you back when I asked you about turkeys in Alabama. Are you hearing as many turkeys as you used to? Or what are your friends experiencing over there?
You know, we've had a real decline in our wild turkey population over the last probably 5 years, maybe 8 years. I just had a friend I talked with Saturday morning there in Coosa County, Alabama, and he manages a 36,000-acre contiguous longleaf pine forest. Largest longleaf pine forest in the state of Alabama. 15 years in a row, he killed 5 birds a year. All mature, 4.5, 5.5-year-old birds. All mature. 15 years in a row. Last 3 years, he's killed 1 bird. And he hunts every morning. Where I hunted there in Hale County, I heard 1 bird gobble. The birds even acted to me differently. They're acting more like rabbits. They're kind of staying in the brush. They're staying on the roost till 10 o'clock. So I'm thinking, what's going on? And I've killed birds on that property before because we meet there every year. But it was different. It's different. It's been different the last 3 to 5 years. It really has. And it's just a complex situation.
Have you seen, because you're getting close enough to home to reference here, and especially because I'm in Sumter County too, it seems to me, listening to everybody, sightings in deer season, people's cameras out, we've actually had an uptick in the last 2 years in the hatch.
Good.
We've experienced good. What you're talking about, 8 or 10 years probably of declines. Scary. And turkeys know they're there. They don't gobble, don't see any. They certainly seem to disappear, which is scary. But I guess what I was getting at, I don't know if it was just us. Have you not noticed any more jakes or anything in the last year or two? Maybe that it turned back up a little bit?
This year, I think it's turned back down.
Wow. That's not good.
Where I'm familiar with. Now, that's right. Just a small area. So, and it fluctuates a lot. So I don't know. We'll have to see. But I think region-wide, they're in decline. If I was to just make that statement, I think NWTF would probably agree with that. And it's just, you know, all wildlife populations ebb and flow. It's just the way it is, you know.
I gotta say, I feel like the people that take matters in their own hands, the gamekeepers, and they practice. It's not just trapping or it's not just this or that. There's many factors, you know. You could give us the 6 or 8 or 10 that are factors, and probably the top 2 or 3 priorities would be enough to really make a difference. But the people that are taking matters in their own hands, when times are tough, it doesn't seem to be as tough. And when times get better, they get rewarded more. It just seems like it is worth it from the ones I know that really work at the practices to help a hatch.
Yeah. And practice a little restraint.
Oh, absolutely. That's part of that. That's one. You know, according to Dr. Chamberlain, that might be way up the list. It's like when you shoot your gobblers so hard, you're creating a headwind. You just about can't get over if everything else is working. And, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. And you've got to protect a portion of your older age class animals. You know, I've been to Alaska 33 times. The most men I've taken on a single trip with 42, but my average is probably 20. My caribou hunt's probably 6 to 8. The Mulchatna herd was one of the finest caribou herds in the world, 36,000 animals.
What kind of caribou was that?
Is it called the Mulchatna herd?
But what is it, a mountain caribou?
No, it's a barren ground.
Barren ground, okay.
I've been to, that's the only time I've been up there. That's where I was.
Yeah.
Mulchatna River.
Kuskokwim Mountains.
Moose there.
I'm telling you, it was an unbelievable hunting experience. We overshot the harem bulls, and the population went down to about 3,000 animals. We've had no non-resident hunting now for about 15 years, and it's never built back. And they're talking about they had some hoof rot, they had this and they had that. But I just think they overshot the harem bulls. It caused so much confusion in the harems that the subdominant bulls became kind of confused almost, and it increased predation. It reduced fawning and twinning. The calving was reduced. And I don't know. The herd's never come back. You know, now I'm hanting a Western Arctic herd up north of Kotzebue. And it's like that's the only herd you can really hunt now except the porcupine. So you can affect that through hunting. So some restraint is
Yeah, that Ungava herd that's it was in northern Quebec. Toxie and I, we went and hunted it years ago. I don't think they've had a season in 10 years up there.
My goodness. Mm. I know the woodland herd, like in Newfoundland, is very low. I mean, they only have like 10 permits a year in the whole island of Newfoundland for that woodland herd.
Just endless numbers.
Well, yeah. I read today that there's a herd of woodland caribou, I believe I got this right, in Alaska, that's making a little bit of a comeback.
It is.
But the wolves, they're saying if these things are going to make a comeback, we're going to have to really get after the wolves.
Yeah, the wolf reintroduction in the Yellowstone ecosystem, they brought that Yellowstone elk herd down from in the high 30,000s down to about 1,500, maybe 2,000 animals.
Oh my gosh.
It's not even a huntable herd now. Now, the Colorado herd going way up right now.
They don't have wolves. So.
No, they don't have wolves.
Well, they've just got some introduced. and then I read this morning, ironically, that there was a wolf killed in Colorado that its gene, they traced it back to Minnesota.
Minnesota, yeah.
It was a rancher killed. It was getting after some cattle. So,
my goodness.
But Colorado's got wolves now. Dudley, they introduced 10, didn't they?
I think so.
There's just a lot of interesting stuff going on in the people trying to manage wildlife. And
you're kind calling it interesting, too.
I've been diplomatic, which
is good, but I would use the other.
There's a lot going on. Herbs. And a guy as smart as you are, Mark, you probably read and watch this and you're shaking your head. You know, we look at a lot of these wildlife departments now. We hear that a lot of the kids coming out of college and moving into these departments may not have the background, didn't grow up coon hunting and understanding how important harvest is in some situations. And so a lot of these departments have some headwinds along those lines.
Well, yeah. Actually, a lot of them are anti-hunters. They actually do everything they can to reduce hunting and to eliminate hunting and to reduce hunting access. And that's been going on now for 30 years, and it's having an effect on our federal land, which is owned by all of us. You know, the federal land's not owned by the Sierra Club. It's owned by the taxpaying citizens of the United States who should have access to it. So it's not just that they don't have a hunting background. They have an anti-hunting background.
Yeah,
and they're populating all of our agencies, unfortunately, state and federal.
Mac, you look like you got a question.
I do. So we just came out with the 2024 turkey stamp. So that is definitely one thing gamekeepers can be doing right now. But I want to know from Mr. Mark, what are some other things some gamekeepers can be doing on their properties this time of year at the end of April?
Oh, gosh. Most everybody's in the middle of turkey season right now, and they don't have a lot of management going on.
So are you doing mineral licks? Are you planting warm season annuals right now? Or?
So from May until October, I mostly just work up in the Northeast. And so I've kind of morphed a little bit away from active management in the Southeast to doing most of my work in the dormant season. Now, that's during deer season. But I've been doing a lot of ecosystem restoration. I've done 12 jobs since October, and I've got about 4 more to do before I leave at the end of May. So I've kind of, you know, I was telling Bobby earlier, I'm 50% retired now, so that means I only work 12 hours a day.
That's probably a true statement.
It's been a tremendous quality of life improvement. For me and the wife, who I got her wearing shoes now half the time. So she's from Booger Holler. As you all know, she's the president of the Booger Holler Possum Ranch. But so I have been getting a little bit away. I've done that for 23 years, all the field work, which I would be starting up now. But I've been kind of moving away from doing this dormant season work, which I do a lot of tree planting in the winter, too. I'll plant a couple million trees every winter and then do the ecosystem restoration work in between. And sometimes I use crews. Sometimes I just do it myself because I enjoy it, and it does keep you in good physical condition, you know.
Well, Well, so, you know, this time of year is it's a good time for contemplation.
And to think what you're doing.
Sitting in the woods and turkey hunting and walking around and scouting. So, yeah. You know, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I know right now I'm gearing up for Kogan grass control. Mm. It is going to be an environmental nightmare.
Tell us the history real quick. Bring us up to speed.
It came in the port down in Florida, and our dear friends across the ocean were packing dishes in it. They were using it for, you know, to keep breakage down in their shipping containers.
Jeez.
So it came from China, and then when it was, I guess when it was taken out of all of the containers, all that stuff was landfilled. Well, all that Kogan grass that was used in those containers to protect dishes and glass objects was put in the landfills, and it just started emerging from these landfills, and it spread all over Florida. And now it's spreading all over everything south of 80. In Alabama, it's full. You can't drive down to the beach without seeing Kogan grass on both sides of the highway as far as you can go, encroaching into private property. We've got it here. I just saw a patch of it on 82.
Well, yeah, north of here.
Yeah, yeah, it's everywhere.
What's it look like?
It looks kind of like broom sedge, but it stays browner a little longer, and then the new shoots emerge and become green. And then about this time of the year, they start having a white seed head, mm-hmm. and it waves. And once you see those patches, they're always circular.
Yeah,
you can't miss it.
Yeah, you can.
And there's nothing because I guess the roots
have a lila pattern.
Yeah. So it's completely solid with it. There's nothing that can live within inside of a colony of it.
But you can see it from an aerial map.
It's
like Mark said, it's little circles on the landscape.
And it'll actually kill your conifers eventually, even the mature conifers. So identify where you have non-native vegetation on your property, and it'll be Kogan grass this time of the year. Go ahead and spray it before seed heads. Amazapyr plus glyphosate, 0.5% amazapyr, 3.5% glyphosate, spray to wet. And spray a buffer around each because they're coming out through the rhizomes. Mm-hmm. So spray a buffer around each circle and flag them.
So it'll have a residual.
The amazapyr will have enough residual to control the root systems and the nodules. And then look at your Chinese privet. It's flowering out right now. It's fixing to seed out.
Ooh, I hate that stuff.
Spray all your Chinese privet. Look at your kudzu. Spray your kudzu. Look at Tree of Heaven or any other.
I'm about to have a wage war on Sericea.
Yeah.
At my place.
God, that can be a nightmare. Absolute nightmare.
Well, you have a bunch of it?
Well, it's all up and down any road or fire lane because, you know, a previous landowner was mm-hmm. probably told by somebody that was an official person that it was what you needed to plant for erosion control. And so the beauty of it is you don't really, once you get off of the road systems, you don't see a whole lot of it.
It doesn't like shade. That's at least the one thing about Kogan grass. It does not like shade.
Right.
That's the only thing I've seen stop it is shade.
Yeah. It suppresses it and suppresses the seed head formation too.
But that's a great thing to do in spring is identify a lot of your invasives and come up with a game plan.
I'm hungry for our listeners to learn something that they can go do on their place. One of the things you talk about is ecotones. Could you explain what that is and why you like them so much?
Yeah, an ecotone is a transitional transitional habitat between two adjacent habitats. Say you've got a green field and then you've got a pine plantation, or you've got a mixed pine hardwood stand, or you got a hardwood stand. Normally, there's no transition between those two ecosystems. You've got a open field environment and you've got a closed canopy environment. And if you think about it, the root systems of those mature trees are protruding way out into that open area. And you never hardly ever grow anything in that area, that edge anyway. So what I've always tried to promote is what are called ecotones, which are transitional bands plants that may have some of both features in them. But I like to introduce whistleback, and I add Alamo switchgrass. I add sometimes some native warm season grasses. I'll add corn. I'll add Egyptian wheat, things that have tall structure. And then I'll go through with a backpack and I'll remove low quality plants that I don't want in the ecotones over time, like sweet gum or red maple or box elder, stuff like that, gallberry. And so you want those ecotones to be sort of an early successional mixture of plant communities that are good nesting habitat. It's escape cover. It's actually bedding habitat. They become travel lanes for deer because large antlered bucks would rather be in cover than in the opening.
How wide on average are these things?
You know, probably half a chain, maybe 30 feet. And I like them to be irregular in shape. I don't like them to be straight because your predators are normally running those straight lines. And then we talked about those interspersion index features. Those are very long shooting lanes that intercept sanctuaries. I like the end third to cross a riparian zone. And those are a chain wide, so those are 66 feet. But you have about 20 or 25 feet on each side, which are your ecotones in real wavy lines. And the only the center is planted, so maybe 30 feet. Maybe if you've got a five-foot disc, you're going to plant maybe five or six swaths wide is it.
When you say a riparian zone, you're talking about you like it to go across a creek.
I do. And end it on the other side of the creek, right against the sanctuary. You know, your centrally located sanctuaries are off limits to hunting. I've got a sanctuary on my property I've never stepped in 15 years. I don't plan on stepping into it. I've got a client, I'm starting a timber harvest in June. We're going to harvest about 150 acres north side of a major creek, and we're going to move his sanctuary over there. And in 3 years, the sanctuary will be in the densest vegetation, and we're going to cut the south 150. So you can manipulate your sanctuaries a little bit. I've got a sanctuary on one property, and it's surrounded by a hunting club that's almost 5,000 acres. And this sanctuary is 80 acres. I put out four cameras at the end of hunting season last year. I had 18 unique bucks because the deer around the periphery were coming into the sanctuary and staying there for almost all of hunting season. And I had five shooters.
Wow, on 80 acres.
On 80 acres of a sanctuary. And the way I would hunt that sanctuary is just hunt the periphery. Just hunt the periphery. And you can use those interspersion index features, which are really long linear.
Wait. Interspersion. Okay, yeah, well, I've dumbed that down for me. Okay, what are you talking about, lanes?
Interspersion is a...
There's an index, right?
It's a habitat term. It's an index. It's a numerical value of the number of habitats you have across a landscape. On Dr. Carol Walker's property here in Mississippi.
Yeah.
I talked to his nephew this morning.
Did you?
Yeah.
What a fine man. Well, he had a big pine plantation in the middle of that property. Let's say it was 40 acres. And if you drew an X through it and counted the number of habitats, you have one, right? Well, me and Bobby Watkins, we put three interspersion index through the middle of that property, attached the end center one with a travel lane to a riparian zone, which was a sanctuary. And then you draw an X through that property and you have an interspersion index of 47. You have 47 different habitats now.
I am lost. How did you get to 47
well,
so fast?
Well, you count every habitat. You count the you, we had a if we, an if ecotone were- around it. That's two habitats, one on each side. You got the pine stand. You've got two habitats on either side of the ecotone. You got a habitat in the center. You got two more habitats on the other side of the ecotone. You got another habitat. Then you go to the next interspersion index. You do that three times. You add them all up. It was 47.
Okay.
So it's increasing biodiversity, and it also helps non-game species. I can remember one time on that property, one morning, do a quail count, and I had 19 quail in the middle of a pine stand. that wasn't there before. But we had Milo, we had brown top millet, we had corn, we had clover, we had iron clay cowpea, we had buckwheat. We have everything now. And those ecotones add more to the equation than the agricultural plant in the center. And you want those edges to be very wavy. About two-thirds of the way down, I like to have what's called an observation interruption, where the bucks coming out of that sanctuary to the very end, if they're even standing in that Egyptian wheat or Alamo switchgrass or whatever, native warm season grasses, they'll stand in those areas. They don't want to see the whole thing. You only want them to see a small part of it on the other side of that riparian zone.
So they'd have to move to for to
they
see the other
side. They have to move
side.
And they feel safe.
Yeah.
You know, they're carrying a rocking chair on their head and everybody's shooting at them.
Yeah. So
it's a little different.
But you don't want them to be able to see that whole lane.
Right.
They've got to move up to some place right. where it gives you better visibility on
right.
that.
And you want a zone of separation between your hunting access structure, whatever that is. And you want an access trail to the structure itself so that you can observe to see if there's any bedded does. If you bust an alpha doe going in, you're never going to see a mature buck. So you've got to be careful of how you get into your structure. You need to take more time getting into your hunting structure than you do actually hunting. In my opinion, it might take 2 hours or 4 hours just to get, and you need to walk. You know, I had a client.
There's a thought. Mm-hmm. Mac, are you listening to what he just said?
There's a lot of folks on public that are doing that kind of stuff now. Like they know exactly where the deer is, and they take, like you said, they take longer to get to their spot than they do actually hunting just to stay undetected.
I had a client from Greenville call me, and he had several properties, and he leased one big property. It was his grandfather's property. They always had big bucks on that, big swamp bucks. And the hunters were mad. There's no bucks on the property. They're paying a high price for a lease. And they wanted to reduce the lease amount. And he called me and said, "Can you do a census?" I said, "Yeah, man, I'll do a census." So I went in there and I did a census on his property. And when I got the census report done, which I always have a written report with all the photographs, he said, "Let's go meet the hunting club, and I want you to show them the results." So I said, "Okay." And there was about 20 guys in the hunting club. It was a large property. And we were sitting at a table like this, and I had a great big stack of photographs. We had 56 bucks on that property, 56 unique bucks. And I added four more because of the population correction factor that I use. And so we had 60 bucks on that property. And the biggest one scored about 175, and he was a mainframe eight.
Good.
Wow.
He was enormous. And I put all the pictures of all the shooters, and their mouths just dropped. I mean, and they got mad at me. But you know what they were doing? They were driving their four-wheelers underneath their stands. They didn't see nothing but does and button bucks and spikes. And they always swung the gate open, creaking, making a big loud noise when they'd go in. And they'd drive all over the roads, and they'd park right underneath their shooting houses.
Yeah.
I said, "You guys got to quit hunting this. This isn't hunting, you know." And after that, you know, he didn't reduce the lease of the price of the lease, let me tell you, because he had plenty of older age class bucks on that property. They just didn't know how to hunt them.
Did they adhere to your advice?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
Yeah. What about that 175? Anybody?
I don't know if they kill that one or not, but that was the second biggest mainframe 8-point I've ever seen in the state of Alabama.
That's huge.
Yeah. It was his bases were big around my thighs, I think. I mean, he was big. He was huge. And G1s were like 12s. I mean, he was just massive. His G1s almost reached the top of his two.
Yeah, that's a huge deer. I'd like to learn more. You're really good at putting things in layman's terms for people. And
everything he's explaining to me.
One of the things that I just...
You're not a layman, Bobby.
I can't learn enough about is thermals. And, you know, we hunt some hilly ground around here. Can you just explain that to our listeners about how thermals work and how you can use them for, you know, obviously hunting deer?
Yeah, and what we could maybe count on you know, because a randomness to them, you can never help. But there could be some, what can we, you know, like on calm days, what can you maybe expect?
Well,
that we can count on.
I've got to get into a discussion of man-made global warming and climate change.
Oh, here we go.
But it's real simple. Every morning when you wake up, if you look to the east, you will see a large orange globe. And it comes up real slowly, and you don't want to stare right into it. But within
about... Is that
about,
layman enough for you, Bobby?
That's perfect. That is perfect.
I'm tracking with you.
Yeah, within, okay. We got Bobby this time. Good,
this
good.
Is exactly what we need here.
Within 15 seconds, this orange globe heats the landmass up to a point where you have immediate convection currents. Immediate convection currents. I've sat on a heliport 10,000 times and watched that phenomenon as that helicopter starts making his rounds. And, you know, he's picking up 110, 120 gallons of load, doing 10 or 12 acres at a pop at 10 GPA, and he's making a turn, he's making a turn, he's making a turn. And you see the effects of those light winds starting to hit that microfoil boom swath. And you actually want that because it puts the swath down on the ground instead of it moving across the landscape. So you actually want a 3 to 5 GPA wind. And you get that within about 15 minutes, and there you go. Happens every morning, mm-hmm. every morning. So the origin of man-made global warming is that large orange globe that comes out up in the east every morning. And it's a phenomenal. So these bucks, you know, we have so much good information now on buck bedding behavior that we didn't have even 10 years ago. These bucks are moving almost all the time. They're only staying in a bed 2 or 3 hours a day. I mean, they're up. They're making a circuit every 6 days. They're never hardly ever bedding in the same spot twice. They're bedding in the same areas occasionally, and they'll have different bedding areas depending on the wind, depending on the environmental factors that are affecting them that night while they're feeding. And so what I always tell people is, instead of worrying about that, too much emphasis, change your hunting tactics. Change your access tactics. Access your hunting areas by a totally different route that you've never accessed it before. Hunt areas that you've never hunted before that are so thick you have to literally crawl in them. If you can, you need to be able to crawl into those areas on your hands and knees. I wear out a pair of knee pads every year. Every year I wear out a pair of knee pads, and I wear snake leggings too. But come in by canoe or by boat, or by riparian zones. Some clients that have really shallow creeks, we turn those creeks actually into access trails to access stands that are located in places that they've never put them before. Because those bucks, they pattern you, and they know when you're coming, where you're coming from, how long you're going to stay. Sometimes I'll put up a decoy shooting house, and then I'll have a hidden ground blind in another location. And you'll see those alpha does will come out, and they'll stare up in that window for 30 minutes mm-hmm. waiting for you to swat that mosquito. You know, it's uncanny how they've adapted to us. So I gave where Dry Creek Hunting Club is. I gave a seminar to all their hunters about a week ago for Doug Dean. And that's what I was telling those guys. You know, I saw a buck on their property. I was planting a longleaf track, and the buck was in a little island of eastern red cedar in a little alkaline knoll, and he was bedded in there. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll find a shed in there. So I was walking through there. I busted this buck up there. He's probably scored 160, probably one of the biggest bucks on that property, 165. Well, you've got to hunt in places where you haven't hunted previously, in habitat that's too thick to get into. Stay all day, hunt 10 to 2, don't even go out early morning, late evening. Mix it up. And then, of course, about winds, just hunt your winds, side your winds if you can, side them. One of the things that I use is I take the tarsal glands off every buck I kill, and I salt them down, and I tack them out on a board. And I put them in a Ziploc bag, and I just write the county name on it. And I tie those to the instep of my heels, my instep or my heels. And I always walk in with them, and I hunt with them on. And if I go up a tree, and a lot of times I'll actually fell a tree into the crotch of another tree, and I'll hunt right there in that crotch of that tree, and I have four or five of those in a landscape, and hang them on a limb about halfway up. And if a resident buck smells that tarsal off of an unidentified deer, they just go nuts. They don't want that interloper coming in, and they'll tear that place up trying to find that buck. So there's you know, wind, obviously, bucks are always into the wind, and they're always working the wind to their advantage. One of the things I do, like this property I'm getting ready to cut, I'll have my skidder operators take all the tops and put them in, like, they're not really horseshoe shapes. They're more like a kind of like a parenthesis or a bracket, facing the wind on half of them and facing the opposite on the other half. And that way you can work two winds, a southeast or a northwest. See? And those bucks like to bed in those pockets of those tops. I don't know why. They're completely covered on three sides, and they got the wind in their face. I busted three bucks one time out of a farmer's dairy field that were bedded in a sumac patch half the size of that table. And it was a quarter mile to the nearest timber. That was a safe place for them. They probably bedded in those all over that property. And it was incredible because they were enormous. So, you know, your bucks are moving around. They're bedded down different places. And the more you are out hunting, the greater is your probability of intercepting one. You're not going to intercept one when you're laying on the couch or you're fixing bacon and eggs. Hunt all day, or go out from 10 and hunt till 2 or 3 and come back in and vary it.
And mix it up.
Mix it up.
So I like that. That's an alternative answer. That's good.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
The Furminator is the industry's most versatile piece of food plot equipment, allowing plotters to do every step of the process, working the soil, adding seed and soil supplements, and compacting. From start to finish, with a single implement, it's hassle-free by design. Set it for the seed size and simply drive the tractor, and the Furminator does the rest. Check it out at theferminator.com.
Hey guys, Dudley from Gamekeepers here. I want to tell you about the all-new Gunner Dog Bowl. It's designed for home and built for travel. It's customizable, leak-resistant, light on weight, solid on durability, and rust-proof. Like other Gunner products, they're made in Nashville and designed for everywhere.
Nosler is known for their bullets, and now they're making suppressors. Nosler suppressors are made for hunting. Adding a Nosler suppressor to your rifle will make you a quieter, more accurate, and more effective hunter. Protect your hearing and disturb less game with a Nosler suppressor. The time to hunt quiet is now. Learn more at Nosler.com.
You know, it's interesting listening to him talk, though, but how varying things up. That makes I can see that working. I can see that working. We around here kind of have we talk about waiting for the right wind to go in. And we just don't want to go in and mess up a spot.
I'd say half the time I wait for the right wind and I go, and then it's still not the right wind. Or it shifts for part of the afternoon when the wind starts to lay a little bit. What are the most hated words in the English language for bow hunters? The three most hated words: light and variable.
But Mark, we try to do that. I mean, we try to be smart about how we go in and hunt.
Right.
But oftentimes you get there and the wind's different than what you
expected.
What
he's saying to do is really hard to do, because he's made a living actually architecting things so that you have a better chance to do it. But let's face it, nobody can do it every time, no matter how good you are and how good a hunter you are. So, but what we can do is our intention. And I've always said, just sounds a little goofy, but play pretend. I'm going to pretend like I'm going to leave my truck or whatever and be able to get in my stand and be completely invisible and undetected in any way. Because I guarantee you, that's the best way. I can't imagine, in the days when I bow hunted really, really hard, I can't tell you how many times I had my best hunts. I had a climber on my back. I was easing through somewhere. I found something, and I climbed right then. I didn't, like, come back, hang a stand, do anything else. You know, I was slipping through quietly, hung, you know, and then it went downhill from there every time I went back again. Mm-hmm. So just it's just honestly, I mean, not to get – I get on myself sloppiness that costs more people that than anything. Mm-hmm. Just assuming it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Well, look, guys, we've been going a while, and I think we probably want to take a break, and maybe we can try doing another one this afternoon if Mark's up to it. But I'm looking at Mike. I'd like, why don't we ask him a trivia question?
Ooh.
Richie, why don't you take over? Look,
like a trivia question, like, what would you love for lunch?
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that.
I know Dudley's thinking about it.
We need to ask that too.
Yeah. So do you say possum or do you say opossum?
Possum. Yeah, it's possum. The O is silent.
The O is
the
silent.
O is silent. Yeah.
Hey, you got those Teddy Roosevelt glasses on now. What's going on there? So, look, Mark, we've got a sponsor, Sheffield. Let's turn this thing over to him.
Today's trivia is brought to you by Sheffield Financial. Fuel your GameKeeper projects with financing for power sports, outdoor power equipment, and trailers. Begin your next conservation adventure at SheffieldFinancial.com.
So, look, we do this, Mark. We have learned the hard way. We've got some person, some kind listener has left a review, and that person has won a prize. And we've got some great prizes, guys, when mm-hmm. we talk about it. So if you leave a review, you got a really good chance to win a prize. Now you're playing, so we're going to send you back home with some companion shirts and with a t-shirt.
Excellent.
All right. So we'll turn it over to Mike.
All right. So you are playing for a GameKeeper podcast t-shirt that you can get at gkshop.com.
Yeah,
and
nice.
The lucky reviewer is D Marlowe 13, and he's going to win a houndstooth box call, cap, and a decal.
Wow.
That's a nice box call. When it came in, I was kind of playing with it. Mm-hmm. Dudley, it sounds good.
It does.
All right. So the question is, it's right up your alley. What state has the largest concentration of moose besides Alaska?
Maine.
Wow. You know, I kind of figured you'd get that one. That was just a little layup for you. But I don't know that a lot of our listeners knew that. It really had never dawned on me.
They consume an incredible amount of vegetation annually. I've done some studies up there on a statewide utilization of forage, and it's tremendous. They're having a winter tick problem up there now. Game Management Unit 4A is being depopulated primarily due to winter tick research, which I'm more or less opposed to. But they're trying to see if they can reduce winter tick by reducing the population. So it's an interesting population. The only higher density that I'm aware of is Newfoundland.
So, well, you're saying that there's a tick up there that lives on these moose.
Yes.
And they're trying to get rid of the
tick. Yeah, it actually induces mortality population-wide. I've harvested three Maine moose. You have to go into the lottery. A non-resident has a 1.5% chance of winning. I've won three lottery tickets in about the last 20 years. I usually hit on the seventh year, and you've got a three-year waiting period. So that's the fourth year, and you get one preference point per year. I buy three books of 10, so this year I'll have 34 chances, and I hope to hit. And we've got a moose a hunting area up there that is just phenomenal. I have a client that owns property there. I took his son in there several years ago. We killed a number two Maine state record, number four world record, Tioga. There's some big moose up in Maine.
Yeah, how wide would a moose like that be?
About 64. Which, you know, that's big for a Maine moose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really.
There ain't no 72, but we're not in Russia either.
So I always look around the table. Dudley, what did you learn?
I think I learned so much that I can't really narrow it down. But I've I think the interspersion stuff is just fascinating to me. So I want to learn more about that.
Yeah. Once again, as so many of our brilliant friends, there's no magic bullet. And, you know, it's always, I say that, it's almost always a complex answer to your question, you know, out there.
It really is.
And so we'd love to make it simple. We like, you know, people would love to think that you can pour something on the ground and your deer get bigger, you know, or whatever the case is. Or you could just kill all your predators and you'll have a thousand turkeys on your place. And it's just, it's nature's complex. Mm. And you can't listen to him too much. And people like him that we have in, it's just been so enriching to me to listen to him. And I made more notes today than I have with anybody. So.
Yeah. Mac, what about you?
I learned the word herbitat. That was a first.
I did hear him say that, yeah. So what I wrote down, and I think if guys will pay
attention
to this.
There's also rabbitat.
Yeah. Yep. I've heard that one. So what I wrote down, I think if guys will pay attention and we'll look at implementing this, but QVM, quality mm-hmm. vegetative management, mm-hmm. create a sanctuary. Mm-hmm. Then you're a big fan of agricultural food plots. Mm-hmm. We are too. Supplemental feeding if necessary. And then managing that hunting pressure
right.
and your styles. So right. those are things that we can all do.
Yes, and there's no substitute. At the top of the list, I'll speak for you, in getting your deer herd within the carrying capacity. Right. Whether you raise the carrying capacity or you reduce the herd or actually both is best, all of those things pale in comparison to doing that first, right?
That's correct. That's exactly right.
So I've got one more question. These we've got a company we're working with, Nosler, that's making a suppressor. Are you experiencing that guys can use some of this technology and maybe some loads, that subsonic loads, and reduce the noise pollution, noise pressure on a property? And have success with that?
I would think that it would be advantageous, although I don't have specific information on it. But just as my first thought would be, yeah, that'd be great. A lot of properties, when we do early season doe removal, it's always archery for that reason. So if we could go, we would be more efficient if we could go subsonic with suppressors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like it's going to make sense.
Yeah, yeah. And you can take out your coyotes and your hogs and what else comes around.
And not make a bunch of noise.
Yeah, and not affect your deer herd.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're going to get to it hopefully in the next one. But do you do a lot of predator hunting? Like predator calling, coyote?
I promote it on the property that I manage, and most of us have contracts with predator removal services.
Okay, that's awesome.
It's so much, you've got to get a professional involved.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Richie, guys, listen to this. Where could they watch the Gamekeeper television show these days? What night would be the best one and what channel?
All right, so right now, Gamekeeper is airing on Sportsman's Channel, Sundays 9 p.m. Central. And we're going to be moving over in July to Outdoor Channel, airing there.
So, look, we've really enjoyed having you. You're just kind of a treasure in the wildlife world. People that run into you just they really enjoy their experience with Mark Thomas. So I think you do Facebook. Would that be if a guy wanted to follow you or learn more about you?
Yeah, just come on Mark Wilson Thomas and friend me. And that's and I've got a business page as well, Forestry Wildlife Integration LLC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds good. Anybody else got anything? It looks like everybody's pretty hungry.
I do. It's called a grumbling stomach.
Yeah. Why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley. Get us out of here, Mac.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife Magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt Podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.